Life is called inalienable.
What does that mean?
It means that nothing you do can deprive you of these rights. Inalienable means you can't alienate them. You can't make them alien to you. You possess these rights because you're human. Now, if rights really are crucially important, the most important, or one of the most important moral considerations, then of course protecting freedom becomes an extremely important priority, because if you don't have freedom, you can't exercise your rights. The rights may be there abstractly, but they're of no use to anyone if they can't be exercised. And if you want to push it to its logical conclusion, it's not enough merely to protect a person's physical freedom, but if society develops a climate of intolerance, then even if the laws leave room and the government has sufficient power to stop private individuals from tyrannizing people, social pressure can tyrannize people to the point where they will not be prepared to pay the psychological price of exercising their freedom. So if you really believe in rights and freedom, you will want to preach a social attitude of tolerance, perhaps even of encouraging people to develop their individuality and thereby give full expression to their rights. That's the way it is often portrayed. I think there's a good deal of confusion here. Confusion within the outlook of the secular intellectual who espouses or asserts these propositions about rights, freedom, and tolerance. My first point this evening is that he doesn't understand his own position, let alone a critique that I could mount from the outside based on our world picture. But he doesn't understand his own position. At least the vast majority. There may be exceptions, but the vast majority don't understand their own position. And I will try to show this by giving you cases where that same secular intellectual who describes rights, freedom, and tolerance as absolutely fundamental, he will be prepared to sacrifice rights, freedom, and tolerance for the sake of other values, sacrifice them very regularly, I would say, if you analyze it carefully, without exception, to social welfare. Something that promotes the welfare of society will be used to override concerns of rights, freedom, and tolerance regularly, which will mean that rights, freedom, and tolerance, at best, are a secondary consideration, not a primary consideration. Maybe they're not an independent consideration at all. That depends upon how you learn the philosophy. But in terms of the examples, it will come out, if I'm right, that rights, freedom, and tolerance and occupy a secondary position, not a primary position. Let's take a look at some of the examples. Taxation. Every Western liberal society, democratic society that I know of, has an income tax, except New Hampshire. But they have to pay the American national income tax, so they don't really get free. Many have a graduated income tax, which means the more money you earn, the higher a percentage of your income you have to pay. So let's just take a hypothetical example. A person's earning $100,000 and pays $30,000 in tax. A person is earning $20,000 and pays $2,000 in tax. Now, why is that? Why is the richer fellow paying so much more in taxes? Well, let's ask, why do we pay taxes altogether? Don't forget that the government takes those taxes against your will. It essentially has a gun to your head and says, give me the money or else. Let me just finish the point and I'll be glad to take the question. So why are they taking the taxes? Because the government provides services for the population and they have to be paid to do it, otherwise they can't do it. They build the roads and they make sure the air is pure and they protect against crime and they have an army protecting against external aggression. They prosecute contracts and generally help to make things work. And since they provide services, they have to be paid for. Okay, so why is the rich guy paying 15 times as much tax as the poor guy? Is he getting 15 times as much service? He's surely getting some more service. He probably generates more garbage than the other guys, so the garbage truck has to stand a few minutes extra at his house. He probably has two cars, so he uses the roads more. The guy who's earning $20,000 probably doesn't use the roads at all, not privately. So, indeed, he should pay less. Yes, the rich guy is getting more service from the government. The army functions as a kind of insurance policy for your property. If you have more property, you should pay more premium on the insurance policy. So he's getting more service. So he should pay more taxes, but not 15 times as much tax. He's not getting 15 times as much service. He's paying a surplus. Why is he doing it? Because they have a gun to his head. He can't help it. But what's the justification for doing it? Is the justification protecting rights, freedom, and tolerance? In particular, is it protecting his freedom, the richer fellow? His freedom to do with his money as he pleases? Doesn't sound like it. I don't think you can justify a graduated income tax on the grounds of rights, freedom, and tolerance. Now, we all know the correct answer. The correct answer is you're taxing the rich guy to pay for services for the poor guy, because his $2,000 will cover his services. Or take the really poor, don't pay any taxes at all, and they're getting the services anyway. Somebody's got to pay for that, so the rich guy pays for it. Now, here's my point. It is morally correct to do this. It is morally correct to do this. I'm not attacking this. I'm just doing a philosophical job. I want to know why it's correct. Is it a matter of protecting rights, freedom, and tolerance? Is that the explanation for why we take the money from the rich and use it to pay for services for the poor? My contention is no. That's not the explanation. The explanation is welfare. It's good for society as a whole, for the differences in the level of income and the level of standard of living not to be too drastically different. It's good for society as a whole. It promotes solidarity, cooperation, efficiency, which is good for everybody. It's good. It's good. It promotes happier lives, richer lives, whatever you like. So what are we doing here? We are overriding rights. We're telling the rich guy, you cannot spend your money as you please. We are enforcing charity. This is enforced charity. I tell you, the guy, you cannot decide to spend your money as you please, not all of it. Some of it we're going to take away and give to the poor, because everybody in the society will be better off if we do that. That is a case of sacrificing rights and freedom, on the one hand, for social welfare on the other hand. Question?
I was just going to say, I think I would argue that you could have, that you need social welfare for even the rich guy to be able to support his freedom and his, I mean, if there's chaos all around, how could there be like the ideal of freedom and equality and all these things for everyone if everything's in chaos, if there's an order, if there's an education for everyone? And maybe for that individual, he's paying for social welfare, but it's also for himself. I mean, he doesn't want to live in a place where the roads are dirty and where equal
amount,
so he's saying like the ideal.
Okay, but now let's be careful to keep the category straight. Chaos is one thing, and dirty roads is another thing. Dirty roads does not mean you have any less rights. Dirty roads is the quality of life. That's my point. You're sacrificing freedom and rights for the sake of a higher quality of life. My point was that rights and freedom are not so fundamental. On the contrary, they take second place to social welfare. Quality of life is fairly close to the idea of social welfare. It's either a case of or synonymous to social welfare. So you really are sacrificing it. Now you talk about chaos. Well, in the southern United States, before the Civil War, I don't think that chaos was the problem. And they managed to have a pretty thriving economy on the basis of slave labor. So I don't know whether you really have to promote equality of income in order to protect yourself against chaos.
There wasn't freedom.
Correct. Right? Correct. Again, what was your point? Your point was that you might want to equalize income so as to protect against chaos, so as to protect your rights. Because in chaos, nobody can exercise any rights. I'm pointing out that you can have gross differences of income with perfect order, and the rights of those who have them are not threatened at all. So that would not be a very strong justification for equalizing income. The threat of chaos with unequal income is probably not a very real threat. India has lived with that for decades, and has not dissolved into anarchy. China has lived with that for a century, and has not dissolved into anarchy. I mean, it doesn't sound like a very strong threat, protecting against chaos, as a justification for giving more money to the poor.
How about freedom for education? Let's say, so you'd be paying, your example, you'd be, the richer person would be contributing more for the poor person's education.
Yeah, I tried to avoid this, but since you raised it, maybe I should say a word about this, because I just tried to skip a step, but if it's not going to work. The word rights has come to mean, in some people's mouths, two different things. Liberals invented the second meaning and then systematically blur the meanings so as to create confusion and push their political platform. So it's very important to get the two meanings separate, understand the difference, and make sure you know what you're talking about. The classical meaning of rights is totally negative. Rights mean rights to be left alone. Just don't interfere with me. Rights and freedom, that's why I spoke about rights and freedom. Rights and freedom have become almost synonymous. A right is your moral guarantee to your freedom. The right is the moral reason why you should be left alone to do as you please. All of the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution are, in this sense, negative rights. Not a single one supports a claim. All of them are rights to free speech, rights to freedom of assembly, rights to freedom of movement, meaning just get out of my way and leave me alone. Let me do as I please. That's the basic meaning of rights. Everyone agrees that this meaning of rights is a correct meaning. And the liberals invented something else. A right to education. That's a quite different matter. That's not a matter of being left to do as you please. That's a matter of A, paying for B's education. That's what some people call positive rights or claimant rights. On the basis of that right, one person can take something away from somebody else. Now, morally speaking, that is an entirely different matter. It may be justified, but it's justified for different reasons. It's an entirely different conception. Positive rights are essentially a kind of claim of charity. That it is morally appropriate for one person to support somebody else's needs in some way or other. A right to a minimum wage. A right to a minimum wage and a right to free speech have nothing to do with one another. A right to free speech is, let me talk, get out of my way. It does not mean that you have to pay for my time on the radio. No right to free speech gets me the right to make you pay for my free time on the radio. Now, everyone feels intuitively that negative rights, rights to freedom, are very important. So what do the liberals do? The liberals created the second meaning, positive rights, and systematically blur the two of them so that the terrible importance, the tremendous importance of negative rights now drips over illegitimately to the positive rights which push their social program. The two have nothing to do with one another. Morally, they have nothing to do with one another. If someone denies your ability to speak, he has treated you unjustly. treated you unjustly. If someone denies your claim to charity, which may be a morally justified claim, they've not treated you unjustly. My example is this. If you go to drive your car, and I put a gun to your head and say, give me the keys, and I throw them down the sewer, and I tell you, you're not driving your car today. I have violated your rights to drive your car, and I have treated you unjustly. If you want to borrow my car, now, I have no use for the car this afternoon. You need to drive your mother to the hospital for a life-saving operation. It's clearly, morally obligatory upon me to lend you my car. And I don't. I have treated you wrongly, immorally, but I've not trampled your rights. You have no right to my car. And I've not treated you unjustly, though I have treated you wrongly and immorally. So the conceptions here are quite separate. A liberal will argue, let's take the right to freedom of movement. No one can stop me from going wherever I please. But let's suppose I'm so poor I can't even pay bus fare. So the liberal will say, what good is your negative right to be left alone, to travel where you please, if you haven't got the ability to go anywhere? Now, that is a correct observation. The negative right to go where you please isn't worth anything to you if you can't get anywhere. It doesn't follow that your right to move includes your right to bus fare. It just doesn't follow. What follows is that rights aren't worth a lot, unless you have something else which enables you to use them. But it doesn't mean you have a right to something else. It just means that something else is necessary for you to exercise these rights. Dripping over the word right is just a calculated confusion in order to push a political program. So I suggest that we give these things different labels because they deserve different labels morally and talk about them separately. I was talking about negative rights. Rights to freedom, rights to be left alone. Tolerance. Tolerance means let people do as they please. Tolerance alone does not require you to give them a means to do what they want. That's not tolerance. That's more than tolerance. That's support. Tolerance and support are two different concepts. So my point was that people tend to feel that negative rights are absolutely fundamental status. I'm now contrasting negative rights with welfare. Welfare is the province of positive rights. Very good. Now, I'm pointing out that, without using the term positive rights, which I think just creates confusion, and I call it social welfare, as did John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham and all the other classical philosophers, that, in fact, when we consider our judgments, we are prepared to put social welfare before rights, before negative rights, before rights to freedom. And that comes to most people as a bit of a surprise. Because when they think of rights and how fundamental they are and how important freedom is, they think freedom must be the most important thing, or certainly as important as anything else. And now you see, I have five examples, where most people, the vast majority of people, except for libertarians, the vast majority of people will feel that it is appropriate to tax the rich and to force them to give to the poor. Libertarians are the exception, and these people have a consistent position outside what I'm talking about. I'm not talking to them. I'm talking to liberals. Yeah.
When I think of rights, I think most people would include the whole social aspect of positive rights as being part of rights.
Okay, then, as I say, what you have then is a calculated confusion of terminology, because the cases are really very different from one another. There's a difference between my stopping you using your car and my refusing to lend you my car. Morally, they're not the same, even though they may both be bad, but they're not the same.
Are you arguing, in general, against American thinking?
No, it works the other way. America started very close to a libertarian philosophy. That's why I quoted from the Declaration of Independence. That's why I cited the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. Today, American thinking is very much in terms of social welfare. The examples that I'm going to give you are examples that are law and practice in America today. As far as I know, there are no libertarian politicians elected anywhere in the United States. So libertarianism is a philosophy. I know that there were certain people at Harvard, like Robert Nozick, who became famous in preaching it, but it has almost no followers. Very, very small. The vast majority of the people I'm talking to are liberals, and I think the liberals are confused in their own conception, because when they talk about the freedom, they make freedom to be something an absolutely fundamental idea, and yet when it comes to these practical decisions, freedom takes second place. And the negative rights which support them take second place. Then I think the whole position has to be recalculated.
Yeah. they change their terminology to say that freedom includes those positive and negative rights, wouldn't that be the same thing?
No, because you would know that the positives always take precedence over the negative. You would think of them as more or less on a par, and I'm arguing that they're not on a par. Imagine you alternate years. 1 year you have the graduated income tax, and the other year you have a flat tax. So to equalize things out, let people give voluntary charity 1 year. What would happen to the system? It would collapse. So it's not equal. It's one takes precedence clearly over the other. Yeah?
I don't think it's a problem of morals when you said that. I think it's something about 5% of the population pays 50% of taxes. So it's the rest of everybody getting it up on 5%. They don't really have much, and there's also rent control issues, things like that.
Why don't you think it's a moral problem?
Because these people are not, it's not a moral thing. It's most of the population. I mean, most people rent as opposed to owning.
Let me understand you. You're telling me that the majority have ganged up on 5%, and they're forcing them to pay, and it's not a moral issue?
It's not, because it's somebody who jacked most of the people, and they're following with everybody else because they go along with it.
Why isn't it a moral issue? If a majority gangs up on a minority and takes things away from them, isn't that a moral issue? Sounds to me like you take anything from anybody, even if it's 100 to 1, if you take something from the one that's not right to take, it's a moral issue. Seems to me. Okay, let's take another example. I'm driving through backwoods Iowa. And I see a farmer milking his cow, and I think, I have never had milk direct from the spigot, you know, direct from the cow, from the udder. I'm on vacation. Isn't that what you do on vacation? Have new experiences? So I pull my car over to the side, and I say to the farmer, how much do you want for a glass of that fresh milk? And he says, 50 cents. Hey, from New York, 75 cents. So I said, 75 cents, and he draws it into the cup, and I give him 75 cents. He hands me the cup. Out from behind the bushes come two state troopers, off to jail. Why? Because it's unpasteurized milk. And here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, you cannot buy and sell unpasteurized milk. You can't do that. It's against the law. Now it's state laws, but as far as I know, every state has such a law. Now, can you justify a law against buying and selling unpasteurized milk on the grounds of protecting rights and freedom? Protect my rights and protect my freedom. Leave me alone. Don't tell me what to do. I don't get it. Of course, see, you're protecting health. And health is very important. Quite right. It is very important. And what you're telling me then is that health overrides my freedom and my right to do what I please. Now, true, if there's fraud, you know, if it is advertised that it could cause you a disease, fine, so you should advertise it. Make the farmer put up a sign. This is not pasteurized, and therefore it could contain bacteria. Very good. But beyond that, and the same is true with seatbelts in your car, how can the state tell you how to drive in your car? If they told you what music to play in your living room, there would be a revolution. No one would tolerate that. But you see, it's dangerous in the car. So it's my life. I want to skydive? I skydive. I want to drive my car without seatbelts? I drive my car without seatbelts. No, you can't do that. Now, is this protecting rights and freedom? Telling me I must wear my seatbelt? Doesn't sound like it. What it's doing is protecting my health. Again, don't make a mistake. I'm in favor of all this. I'm in favor of all this. This is all morally correct. I don't want to know why it's morally correct. Am I... thesis is, it's morally correct because it supports welfare, which in this case, as in, I think in almost all cases, is more important than rights. Yeah.
The immediate impact is on your health or your safety. But the long-term impact is on your safety. Health and safety are what I would call ingredients to your freedom, because with neither health nor safety, you have no freedom.
You're right. So is breathing. But as I said before...
the laws protect clean air.
That's a different matter, because that's where he's polluting my air.
Well, your reckless driving is, you know, infringing on my freedom, on my life.
That has nothing to do with my seatbelt. That has to do with my speeding. Yes, we can stop your speeding because you're speeding endanger somebody else. That's another matter. Then you're infringing on his rights. That's quite true. Injuring somebody else is infringing on his rights. But not a question of protecting my protecting mine. Now, I said before, this is when I talked about negative and positive rights. There are many things I have to have in order to be able to exercise my rights. It doesn't follow that I have a right to those things. That just doesn't follow. It's important to have them in order to promote the exercise of my rights. Doesn't mean that I have a right to them. In particular, if in order to exercise my right to ride the bus, I need your money, it doesn't follow I have a right to your money. It just follows that I'm in a pickle, that I can't exercise my rights. Indeed, no one can exercise all his rights. I don't got the time. I have the right to go anywhere I want. I can't go to all those places. There are always limitations on your rights. And the fact that I don't have the resources, you know, I couldn't have afforded a ticket in the Concorde even when it was flying. That doesn't mean that I have a right to somebody give me $10,000 so I can buy a ticket to fly in the Concorde. It's a right I can't exercise because I don't have the means to do it.
At which point in this philosophy do children become involved? Mm-hmm. Because children.
Next example.
Okay.
Let's bring children.
No, I was just saying the seatbelt was a smoker's fire. So once the seatbelt wasn't buckled, it's just like a gateway to him flying, him creeping through my back windshield, you know, because it's something else. So not by not doing the seatbelt, it's just one step before the.
So we're concerned about his going through his windshield and then through your back windshield and hitting you. That's the concern. I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that's okay. I mean, I suppose it's possible, but I don't think that's what they're worried about. That's not the way it's advertised. Anyway, let's take children. In most Western liberal societies, there's public education. Free public education up to some point or other. And I believe that parents have the right, if they so desire, not to send their children to public school if they agree to educate their children at home up to a certain curriculum. State sets a minimum curriculum, and every child must be educated at least with that minimum. And in every case, I believe, that minimum includes literacy. Every child must be made literate, if he's at all capable of it. Now, let's imagine parents who say, you know, all that back and forth, left to right motion of the eyes isn't healthy for the brain. It stultifies the brain, you know. The brain needs to be out of doors, learning about the birds and bees, you know, and the roots and the berries. You know what? Let's give the child his own choice. Why impose this on him? Let him decide when he's 16 whether he wants to learn to read or write or not. We don't believe in imposing this on young children. We think that it's unhealthy psychologically and physically. They're nuts! They have their theory. What is democracy about? What is rights and freedom and tolerance about? Isn't it letting people follow their own star, chase their own dream, live their own lives, make their own decisions, set their own priorities? Nobody would tolerate it if the government decided that every kid whose last name begins with K has to learn the saxophone. Nobody would tolerate it because it's tyranny. What was were you to tell people who should learn the saxophone, who shouldn't learn the saxophone? Quite right. But when it comes to literacy, all of a sudden we fold our cards and say yes. At the point of a gun, every child shall be made literate. Why are we giving up our natural rights and freedom here? The answer seems to be that literacy is overwhelmingly important for welfare. Welfare of the child himself and welfare of the society as a whole. If it's a democratic society, the quality of decisions depends upon the general education of the electorate. And if they can't read, it's going to be very difficult to educate them as to what the issues are. A person who can't read is going to find it very difficult to get a job. Even though something like 25% of Americans are functionally literate. But then they have instructions and pictures rather than in words. But for the vast majority of people, reading is a very important ingredient in getting a job. And getting a job means being productive for yourself and a productive member of the society as a whole. So we take away the freedom from the parents to educate their child or train them and bring up their child as they see fit when it comes to literacy. Because the welfare of literacy is so overwhelmingly important, it justifies taking away rights and freedom. So that's the third example. Integration, which nobody remembers anymore because it failed. But There was a time when people enforced Title I, Title II, Title III, non-discrimination, so forth and so on, enforced the integration of schools by busing kids all over the city to make sure that each school fulfilled its racial quotas. And places of employment and places of entertainment. Now, I'm from Tennessee, and I built a luncheonette with my own hands. I bought the ground, and I built the luncheonette, and I bought the machines, and I cooked the food, and I serve it. And I want to serve people with blue eyes whose last names begin with Bell. Those are the people I want to serve. It's my luncheonette, my food, my labor. Along comes the state and says, too bad, you will serve whom we want you to serve, not whom you want to serve. We don't care who you want to serve. We're telling you have to take in all normal people. Who are they to tell me what to do with my luncheonette? If they would tell me to do it in my living room, that would be considered a tyranny and there would be a revolution. Who are you to tell me what to do in my living room? Well, it's my luncheonette. The answer is that discriminatory practices leads to a breakdown of solidarity in society and leads to a lower quality of life for everybody. And therefore it was decided that we should outlaw these practices, which means taking away rights and freedom for the sake of the general improvement in the quality of life. There are no rights here. No one has a right to eat in my luncheonette. Not a moral right. Just any more than has a right to camp in my living room. My luncheonette is my living room. But the government says, we're going to force you to take them in, because it's good for society as a whole to do that. And again, I agree to this. I think this is correct. Well, what's correct? What's correct is that social welfare takes precedence over rights. Yeah.
We're going to the question and like black ties and different types of ways of discriminating people out.
That's a good question. I guess you've gotten to the point where you can't tell a restaurant that you have to serve cheap meals so that people of lower income can get in. But, of course, it's a good question. Maybe you can plead that it's not directed at a group of people, it's not directed at income. And theoretically, income can go up and down, so it's not Joe Smith who's discriminated against it. People's income don't fit it. But I could hear
some of the issues. Case before the Supreme Court about affirmative action, people keep mentioning now the legacies. Universities will give preference to students, whose parents were big donors or might be donors.
Okay. I mean, these are issues. This is interesting issue. Anyway, I think what you see here is that social welfare takes precedence over rights quite regularly. Now, that means there's some confusion here. People who think of rights and freedom as absolutely fundamental should think again. In our actual practice, in our considered decisions, in the decisions that we think are morally correct, we regularly give precedence to welfare over rights and freedom. Just as a historical footnote worth 60 seconds, John Stuart Mill wrote on liberty. When I was in college, every student in America had to read on liberty. Nobody could get away without it. And he is presented as the champion of rights and liberty. It's a mistake. Mill is a utilitarian. He wrote a book called Utilitarianism, which is one of the fundamental books of ethics. And he says in On Liberty that I'm a utilitarian, and utility is the only moral principle that I recognize. And here's an illustration of it. Mill has a chapter on free speech. Why should people have their freedom to speak protected? Now, if you think rights are important, the question is almost nonsense. Why? Because you have a right to speak as you please, within very broad limits. Don't yell fire in a crowded theater. But, Mill asks the question, why should the freedom of speech be protected? Now, listen to his answer. The answer is that if people speak freely, you're more likely to arrive at the truth than if they don't. And it's very valuable to know the truth. It's very important for things that you want to get done. That is not an answer in terms of rights. Try justifying pornography that way. Freedom for pornography is protected because if you have free pornography, therefore you're more likely to get at the truth. I don't think that'll work very well.
Whereas if you thought there was a fundamental right to speak as you please, it's very difficult to oppose pornography. Miller's a utilitarian. Rights are only as important and as pressing as the utility that they generate. The whole justification is utility. There's no independent concept of rights whatsoever. Rights don't exist. Only utility exists. Only sometimes it's useful to protect people's freedom. And when it's useful to do so, we will do so. But rights have no independent existence at all. So you can really take two positions here. You can go with Mill and be 100% one-dimensional. The only thing that counts is utility. And you recognize pseudo-rights when it's good for utility to do so. Or you can have a two-tiered system, utility and rights, recognizing that usually rights are number two, not number one. Rights and freedom. Okay? Now all of this is background to what I really want to spend a few minutes talking to you about. And that is the Jewish position. And I give you this background for the following reason. That in the Jewish position, there's no such thing as rights altogether. There isn't even a word for it. The concept doesn't exist. Now, if you thought that rights are absolutely fundamental and you can't get along without them, you might be very upset. What do you mean there's no such thing as rights? Now, you recognize that in your own thinking, and in thinking of the liberal world, rights come second, or maybe, according to Mill, they don't have any independent existence at all. Maybe, there's no enough mental space to be able to hear this. I have read historians, this is not my area, but I've read historians who say that in the ancient world altogether, there's no concept of rights. It was invented in the Protestant Reformation when Luther wanted to oppose the church in Rome and wanted his conscience to be what determined for him what should be right, what should be correct, just, moral. So the doctrine of rights was sort of invented to give them that loophole. Be that as it may, in Jewish thinking, there is no such concept. In modern Hebrew, they had to borrow a word. Zechuyot ha'adam is what they call the rights of man in modern Hebrew. Taking the word zechut. Zechut really means merit, or it means purity, or it means being on the winning side in a court action. It has nothing to do with rights. They borrowed the word, like they do in modern Hebrew for many concepts. They don't have a classical word. Now, the question is this. If you subtract rights altogether, let's just imagine that we have no business or thing as rights. No concept of rights. What do we lose? What morally do we lose? How different would our lives be? How different would our conceptions be? How different would our practice be if you subtract rights altogether? First point I want to make is not as different as you think. Because you can imitate rights. You can create pseudo-rights with obligations. If obligations remain in place, the loss of rights is nitzugefelech, if you have to say the issue. It's not so terrible. Watch. This is my watch. My 150 memory data bank Casio watch, which is totally out of date because I have a palm. But all right, you know, once upon a time it was really very useful to me. Now, it's my watch, which means I have property rights in this watch. You are morally forbidden to steal it or destroy it, because in so doing, you violate my rights to my watch. We could put it this way. My right to my watch creates an obligation on you not to interfere with my use of it. Because it's mine, I have property rights to it. Because I have property rights to it, you have an obligation not to interfere with my use of it. And then at the end of the line, what stops you from interfering morally? Your obligation to leave it alone. Now let's just imagine a case where we subtract the right and leave the obligation in place. Aren't you still morally prohibited from interfering with my use of it? If the prohibition is there, if the obligation to leave me alone is there without the right? The bottom line with the right was that it created the obligation. Suppose I created the obligation without the right. How could I do that? Here's how. There are no rights. None whatsoever. You're drowning. I'm not wishing this on you, I'm just using the example. You're drowning. Peter jumps in and at great risk to himself saves your life. Pulls you out. You say, Peter, you saved my life. Oh, you're wonderful. If you ever need anything, just call on me. You know, I owe you my life. Peter says, okay. A month later, you get a call. Hello, it's Peter. Oh, Peter, you saved my life. How wonderful. What can I do for you? Peter says, I have a request. Now this is going to sound very weird, but this is my request. I want you to promise me that you will not interfere with Gottlieb's use of his watch. And you say, what? What? You want me to promise I won't interfere with Gottlieb? Yeah, I told you it'll sound weird, Peter says. That's what I want. Promise me you won't interfere with Gottlieb's use of his watch. She said, well, Peter, you're right. It definitely sounds weird, but I owe you my life. I owe you my life, so I'm promising you not to interfere with the watch. Now, you are obligated not to interfere with my watch. This has nothing to do with rights. You're obligated because you promised Peter. So that's how you could have an obligation with no rights. Is my freedom protected? My freedom to use my watch? My freedom to be unencumbered, uninhibited by you in the use of my watch? Definitely. You are morally obligated not to interfere with the use of my watch. So, subtracting rights doesn't make a tremendous difference if we have obligations which can protect our freedom. We say everyone has a right to life. One thing a right to life does, it means that other people can't kill you. If they kill you, they're violating your rights, your right to life. In other words, your right to life creates an obligation on them that they shouldn't kill you. Now subtract rights. Subtract them. But imagine if the creator of the universe says, I command you, thou shalt not murder. That creates an obligation. Now you have an obligation not to murder. Aren't other people's lives morally protected just as they would be, or at least as much as they would be if we had rights? All the rights do is create an obligation to leave people alone. Here you have the obligation to leave people alone. So subtracting rights isn't such a terrible, terrible disaster for morality if you have obligations to use, and we have plenty of obligations. Obligations are no problem for us. Now, there are differences, but they're pretty subtle. They're pretty subtle. Back to the watch. I say to you, yo, data bank, 150 memories. I overpaid for it in Radio Shack. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, like everything else in Radio Shack stuff. But you know, I have my palm and I can use it. I don't really need it. You know what? Take it away, smash it, please, please. I really don't care about it anymore. Now, if we start with my right to my watch, and that gives you an obligation to leave it alone, what happens when I say the words I just said? What have I done?
Believe me, that obligation.
I've waived my right. A right can be waived. And when you waive your right, the corresponding obligation disappears. If the picture is my rights to the watch create an obligation for you to leave it alone, if I waive my right to the watch, then your obligation to leave it alone disappears. But if your obligation to leave the watch alone is because you promised Peter, then my expression of disinterest in the watch doesn't relieve you of anything. Because you promised Peter. It has nothing to do with me. I mean, I want the watch. It makes no difference whatsoever. Peter told you not to mess with the watch. You promised Peter you wouldn't mess with the watch. Then I can't release you of it. Rights center the moral control in the person who's being protected, and he can waive it if he pleases. Obligations that come from someplace else don't center it in that circumstance. In Jewish law, even if I told you, I don't mind if you smash it, you can't smash it. Because we have a law not to waste useful property. So you can't just smash things. It's forbidden. The fact that I, you know, express no interest in it doesn't relieve you of God's law not to destroy useful property. Let me try to finish. What time is it? Oh, it says on the cast here, that right. Still is useful. Now, so there are some subtle differences between rights and obligations. But it isn't as if when you subtract rights, the moral system goes to pieces and anybody can do as they please, because the system of obligations remains intact. Now, what I want to do is just illustrate for you what happens to our judgments when we operate with obligations and we have rights. First of all, there are no property rights. Indeed, strictly speaking, there's no property ownership. Nothing belongs to anybody. Rather, my relationship to the watch is like this. IBM hires you to run three-dimensional simulations of sailboats. And it gives you a Pentium, what are we up to, 16, right? I don't know. The latest, fastest, gigantic computer. And of course, three-dimensional simulations of sailboats is very difficult. Get the water currents and the air blowing and, you know, pressure of the light beams and who knows what. And you're running this stuff on your computer? Well, you have the password, and nobody else has the password, and you have the key to the office in which the computer stands. Well, it's not really your computer. It's IBM's computer. It's just that you are hired to use this computer to do a particular job, and nobody else can do it. If you get confused and take the computer home for your children to play 3D games, you're going to be in trouble. Because it's not your computer. It's just a work tool assigned to you for your job. All of the items of property that are under my control, in our conception, are work tools assigned to me for the sake of doing my job. None of them belong to me. None of it is my property. No religious Jew has ever given a dollar of his money to charity. Why? Because it's not his money. He's rather like the treasurer of a corporation, and the rules of the corporation are that money should be paid out in certain ways. Now, it's true, the treasurer signs the checks. He doesn't make it his money. And if he gets confused about that, he's going to be in trouble. He's paying out the corporation's money. Well, this Jew has the same attitude towards his own money. It's not mine. It's just that it's put in my care, and God has certain rules by which it should be apportioned out. That's all. So that's what happens to property in this conception. Let's talk briefly about the right to bodily security. Life and life after life is a separate issue. I'm not going to deal with that tonight, so I'll certainly cut some of these. But the right to security of limb. Here's how one thread of the abortion debate goes. At a certain time between conception and birth, the fetus becomes human. This is to rule out Francis Crick's idea that it should be 48 hours after birth so that the parents can inspect the child and say, no, likely to kill him. That was Francis Crick's idea. But we're not crediting that. Somewhere between conception and birth, the fetus becomes human. After it becomes human, abortion means killing a human being. That's very, very serious. I don't say it could never be done, but it's very, very serious. Before the fetus becomes human, it's just a part of the mother's body. And then the argument goes, it's not the Jewish position, as you'll see, but the argument goes, it's part of the mother's body. She has a right to do with her body as she pleases. If she wants to cut off a finger, she can cut off a finger. If she wants to abort, she can abort. It's her body to do with as she pleases. Now, there's a lot wrong with this argument, but the place at which our sources will get off the ship is the next to last step. Yes, before a certain point in time, the fetus is regarded as a part of the mother's body. But the mother does not have the right to do with her body as she pleases, nor do fathers. A person who says, you know, the human body is obsessed with even numbers. 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 nostrils, 2 hands, 10 fingers, 10 toes. It's so boring. I'm going for 9. I'm cutting off a finger, I'm going for 9. Right? You can't do it. You don't have the right to self-mutilate. So in our conception, it is not your body to do with as you please. You have no rights to do with your body as you please. Rather, the Creator who gave you the body, past time, present tense, laid down certain rules for how it shall be used, and that sets the parameters of what you can and cannot do with your body. So just as the mother cannot cut off her little finger as she pleases, so she cannot abort if she pleases. Gosh, I'm pregnant, and I have to go skiing in the Alps in February, and I'm going to be 5 months pregnant. What's going to happen to my center of gravity? Impossible. No, abortion. You cannot do it. Sorry. It's not included in the rules. Okay, just as silly as the nine as the nine figures. So there is no right to bodily security. There's only an obligation on other people to respect your bodily security, and an obligation on the individual to use his body in the appropriate way. I have one more point to make, let me make it now if you have any questions. There is an underlying philosophical difference between the two positions, the position that does accept rights, the position that does not. One very good place to see this is Sir Isaiah Berlin's Four Essays on Liberty, second edition, who has a long introduction he replies to his critics. If you can read sentences that have 200 or 300 words, they're quite clear. It's astonishing. Unlike German sentences. It's written in English, and they're gigantic. Some of them take a whole page. One sentence, and they're really cool. Anyway, Berlin is one of these people who really believes in rights. He really believes in rights. And here's his picture. What makes a human being human is his liberty. His ability to make his own decisions and carry them out. That's what makes you human. Without that, you're not human. This has infinite importance. And therefore, it has to be protected as a top priority. And therefore, now it's my example, take a person who has the ability to become a neurosurgeon and also has an interest in driftwood. And he has enough money to get along. And he chooses driftwood. And decides not to become a neurosurgeon. He has made his own choice. He has expressed the infinitely precious element of his own humanity, which is his own self-determination, and that decision should be respected and endorsed. That's the idea of a right system. The Jewish system is an obligation system. And it starts not with the infinite importance of making your own decision, but in the importance of the ends which you are to decide and carry out. And we would not support the decision to become a driftwood collector. Because you owe it to God and to the world to do what you can to improve it. And you are welching on that obligation if you do not develop the talent to become a neurosurgeon, assuming those are your only two choices between being a neurosurgeon and a driftwood specialist. Driftwood collector. Yes, freedom is important, because only if you have freedom can you carry out any obligations at all. But the freedom is the means, not the end. Freedom is not the essence of the human being. It's his recognition and his commitment to carry out with his freedom those goals that are the crucial goals to be achieved. So this fundamental orientation distinguishes the two systems, and the Jewish system is, as I said, a system that starts with the goals to be achieved and obligations to achieve. Okay. You had a question.
Yeah, you said that you can't just cut off your finger. What if you're born with six fingers? You can't cut off your extra one. So how does that not fall in the mother?
You certainly cannot cut off the extra one.
You can't?
No, of course not, because it's not extra. What makes it extra? It's more than other people have? Okay, let's talk about Einstein. He has an extra IQ? No. Can we just sort of wipe out the last 20 points of his IQ because he's got more than other people?
Well, it looks like a useful finger. But like, what if it's just like a, just an extra finger, can't move it or anything?
Sort of like your hair.
What if it becomes like an
option? Yeah, but you can't take a haircut. No, you can't. You cannot mutilate yourself. And, it's like, when I was a kid, they took out my tonsils because they got infected regularly. And while they were in there, they took out the adenoids as well because the adenoids clearly don't do anything. And they get infected also. So you don't want to do surgery twice. So while you're there, just cut them out. Right? They don't do that anymore. Because they discovered that the adenoids do something. Just didn't know it at the time. And the expectation of finding vestigial organs, because they were all trained by evolution, sort of blinded them into their own pride of thinking they knew everything. So I'm not even talking about the spiritual elements in the body. You don't self-mutilate that unless there's danger, unless God forbid a person has an infection that he can't conquer or something like that. Yeah.
How does Judaism have a take on abortion when rape is involved? That's another sort of critical aspect of how
it is. And I'm not an expert on the Jewish abortion laws. I just used it as an example for this particular philosophical point. There are books on the abortion laws, and I think we have some of them in the library. So I think on medical ethics, and I recommend you look there. It's just not an area that I know. And if you have trouble finding it, Rabbi Tatz of the JLE in London is an expert in his field. He himself is a medical doctor, and he's a rabbi in the medical office in London. Email him, I'll be sure you do it. Put something right here. Oh, okay.
With obligation, so you obviously have someone to give you that obligation. Say, with your example with peace, or within Judaism, there's God to give the obligation. But what if you're in a secular society and you're not convinced of someone giving you the obligations, where would this argument stand?
Yeah, I don't think obligations come necessarily from other people. I think obligations are as much a natural part of our moral thinking as rights are. Neither one is more fundamental, primarily than the other. I'll take an example that I used in another connection. You're standing next to a pool, and an 18-month-old child falls into the pool at your feet, and all you have to do is lean down, grab his shirt, and pull him out. I think you clearly have an obligation to pull him out. You have an obligation to save a life, especially when it will cost you absolutely nothing. It has nothing to do with rights. Even if there's no right to live, saving his life is so precious, so precious morally, and it costs you nothing to do it, but you have an obligation to do it. So I don't think obligations are created only by what are imposed by authorities. Obligations can be just as natural as rights can.
There's something interesting I found out a few months ago. It was called the Prince State Project. It's an effort to get about 20,000 libertarians to move to one state. And by being concentrated that way, to actually have an effect on politics. They actually, right now, they're still trying to select this. There's a couple that's from, say, Wyoming. I think it's just interesting. First of all, it makes a lot of sense. So if you take these beliefs seriously, if you really think this is how government should be, put your money where your mouth is. And move somewhere.
There's
still
money. There's still money. There's still money.
There's still money. Everybody take care of their own wealth.
No welfare, no help, no support. Just enough government, as Rosie said, traffic cop, as you're doing.
Name all the classes.
So people play fairly by the way, that's all.
At some point, I want to do this for quite a while. I want to talk through some political philosophy issues with you.
Okay.
Next couple
of weeks. Okay, fine. The other day, we had us ask you another question.
Yeah.
So it's to do with evolution.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was reading a book, and it didn't go into much detail about modern Darwin's theory of evolution. So I remember when you were talking about Gould. So how does that make
sense? You want to co-host with us?
Yeah.
So, did you see him?
I did not see him, but Rabbi Kopel is one of those people who's pretty good by his word. He says he's going to be here. He's usually here on time. So, are you here?
Really?
Yeah, I haven't seen you around.
How long have you been here?
2 weeks.
Did you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.